This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm Bray Blanks. As we've been discussing, having one of the largest AI data centers in the U.S. has created a lot of economic activity for the region. It's fueling tens of millions of extra dollars in revenue for the city of Abilene. But we wanted to take a look at what this looks like on the ground for Abilene area businesses. So Doug Peters, President and CEO of the Abilene Chamber of Commerce, is here to kind of dig into that with us. Doug, thank you so much for coming today.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, let's start with the big picture. Now, what would be your headline to describe what is going on in the Abilene economy right now?
Welcome to the golden age of Abilene, Texas. How's that?
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, I'm an optimist anyway. People like me who do what I do every day work an entire lifetime to try to help get a community to where our community is. And even though I had little to nothing to do with the good fortune that exists in Abilene, Texas today, it's still newsworthy and it's cheerworthy. And I'm here today to help celebrate that.
Let's take a look back. Can you give us some context for how this time compares to last year or even before then when all this kind of the boom started?
Sure. It's important for Abilenians and listeners to remember that it didn't start off as a massive AI project in Abilene, Texas. It started as something smaller. The Lancium Clean Campus is what we all came to know back, I think, in 2022. And I remember vividly my phone ringing one day and someone saying, "Did you catch what the president of the U.S. just said?" And I said, "No, what was it?" And they said that Abilene is going to be the ground zero for this big AI boom that that the U.S. is committed to. And my immediate reaction was, "What Abilene? Which Abilene is he talking about?" And it was Abilene, Texas. When you're given news like that and it positions your community to be way out in front of something that maybe you were expecting, but you didn't expect all at once so quick, kind of like a heavy rain, West Texas rain, it forces you to think and do things a lot differently. You know, we were preparing to celebrate and we're celebrating the sort of mild economic development opportunity that the Lancium Clean Campus would bring. And then we're told that, oh, wait, there's more. Mm-hmm. And it was so much more that we've all kind of been recommitted, redirected into helping our community maximize and leverage that opportunity.
You obviously are sharing your positive view of this. Do you think there are those that have not that positive
Sure.
of a view about it?
Yeah. Well, what I can tell you is I think there's a tremendous amount of bad information out there. I'll just use one example, housing. Housing is tough. It's tough for a lot of folks. But in a perfect world, we could have seen it coming. We could have gotten out way ahead of it. We could have brought market solutions to bear, because that's what the chamber does, is works with the private sector to help communities respond to these kinds of things. But it didn't happen that way. So in hindsight, would it have been nice to get ahead of it? Sure. We conducted an intensive housing market study that tells us we're in a hyperscale market for housing. When all this started, even back in 22, we were 5,000 housing units short for where our community needed to be. So starting in that housing deficit and then adding a tremendous number of transient workers, as we were at that time beginning to sort of think about what's this going to look like with the anticipated expansion at Dyess Air Force Base, there's layer upon layer upon layer of opportunity that truly trickles down to every small business in this community who opens their eyes and says, "I want to take advantage of this generational opportunity in my community."
Yeah.
And we're here to help them do that.
Yeah. Sounds like, you're kind of saying the old adage, it can be as good as you make it or as bad as you make it.
That's right.
Yeah. The question mark for a lot of Abilene residents, is it going to stay like this? What are your projections for the population growth over the next few years? Or do you think it will fluctuate?
If you were to kind of look at a scale, I think it's going to spike. In fact, transient workers are expected to spike next year, even more than what we have here currently, because there are other data centers in the region that are impacting this market particularly. There's, you know, folks who are working on data centers in the rural communities around us. They're staying here. They're shopping here. They're eating here. They're churching here. They're doing all the things in Abilene because it's an economic regional center. But when you sort of back away and look at, you know, what does that mean for Abilene, basically what it means. And I just left a session called Dias Industry Day, where we brought 50 contractors together and said, hey, this is coming to Dias. We want to get everybody ready so that there's opportunity for everyone. When you approach it that way, that's great. But we've known the B-21 Raider was coming to Dias for at least 10 years that I've been in Abilene. We didn't know that about the AI data centers. So it's our game to lose. And, you know, helping the market understand what's happening here is a responsibility that we take very, very seriously and help that market respond to those real needs that exist here. So housing, the market's stepping up and mm-hmm. it's responding. Does it take us some time to catch up as a community? Sure. But I would much rather catch up than fall behind and try to pull our community off of a respirator.
Sure. You did a survey recently of your chamber members. What are some key things that you took away from that? And what are things that maybe you learned your members might have concern about?
So traffic is a big deal. And my word of wisdom today is just stay off Facebook. Facebook is nobody's friend. That's where, you know, bad information gets multiplied. And
can you expand on that? What bad information are you referencing?
I don't think we're going to see the massive hit on our water supply that folks see. I don't think that, particularly with our work with the legislature in Austin, that we're going to see massive spikes in electricity costs. We're looking at all sorts of alternative energy sources. The companies who are building these data centers and, you know, the future of our military, I think, is going to be grounded on some other resiliency type options that exist. But the world is changing so quickly. What we want to make sure is that everyone who wants an opportunity to take advantage of what's happening, not just in Abilene, Texas, but in the big country region. I think it's fear of the unknown. I think that there are people who don't appreciate the added traffic on our roads, particularly all the belly trucks hauling aggregate. I see them. I dodge them. But I'm a different-minded kind of person. I live for that kind of thing. And it's a good thing if you do it well. And I think just sharing the story and helping people to gain a comfort level can really go a long way in helping everyone to celebrate this generational opportunity.
Great. Doug, circling back to that survey, what are some key points that you took away from that?
You asked me that before, and I totally escaped that.
It's my fault.
How do we take advantage? It was by far the number one. And I will tell you that those companies, we've gotten to know the companies who are here participating in the data centers. We've heard from the companies who want to be a part of the Dias B-21 bed down and the expansion that comes with that. Connecting them to those opportunities is a real privilege for us, and we do that every single day. The other thing is ensuring that we're getting the right information about water and about electricity, and then trying to reiterate the facts versus things that aren't exactly vetted out to be exactly what they're portrayed to be publicly. And then housing. Housing has been a big issue. We don't want our neighbors to be, in a state of homelessness or on the street or even worried about those kinds of things. These people work hard. So the question becomes, how do we help everybody in the community take advantage of this opportunity and to be a part of the winning side of this versus falling into a trap where they've lost their homes, they've lost opportunities? It's a delicate balance. And when you don't have an opportunity necessarily to prepare, creates a need to really get our arms around it quickly and to respond as quickly as we can.
Doug Peters, thank you so much for being with us today. You've shared a lot of great insights with us. Thank you. Doug Peters, President and CEO of the Abilene Chamber of Commerce. This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm Bray Blanks. As Texas farmers face the growing threat of the New World screwworm, their advocates are praising provisions in the Farm Bill that address animal health. Texas Farm Bureau is urging the U.S. Senate to act quickly to pass the Agriculture Act of 2026. KACU's Heather Claiborne spoke with Gary Joyner, Texas Farm Bureau Director of Communications, about the Farm Bill awaiting the Senate's action.
What help could ranchers look for from the animal health piece of the Farm Bill regarding the New World screwworm?
The draft bill introduced by Senator Boozman does provide some additional attention in those areas that are important to Texas in light of the New World screwworm. This is a 900-page piece of legislation that is intended to be a discussion draft on the Senate side. Texas Farm Bureau is encouraged by this step that's been taken. We're encouraged by the provisions that are in it. It's still early in the process, and it's hoped that the committee will begin to look at this bill, work it up, and maybe in August have an opportunity to consider it for passage so the full Senate can then look at it.
And can you tell us what is being considered as far as helping farmers and ranchers with this New World screwworm threat?
There are some specifics that are still being worked out. The discussion draft talks about priority areas. It talks about leveraging additional investment and attention in those agencies that have responsibility for New World screwworm and other emerging pest issues. So it's still to be determined how that's going to be implemented. There are great advancements in some of the other safety net provisions that are important to Texas and farmers and ranchers in terms of just some of the programs they participate in, some of the opportunities they have through USDA. So all that's encouraging. The House has passed its bill and been approved and is now awaiting action by the Senate. So this is an important step they've taken on the Senate side to begin their discussion of what they call Farm Bill 2.0.
And the Farm Bill does touch so many aspects of life in America. Are there any pieces that you think may be sticking points for getting it done?
It's been said that the Farm Bill is maybe not even the appropriate term to describe the importance of this legislation. It really is the nation's food bill. 85% of the funding in a Farm Bill traditionally goes to food and nutrition programs, SNAP programs, as they're called. So it is a heavily invested piece of legislation, not only for food production, but for food distribution for those that are in need. So it's an important piece of legislation that historically has attracted both rural and urban representatives and members of the Senate. It's one that traditionally is bipartisan, attracts both Democratic and Republican support. This year, we're hoping that both parties, both chambers, can get together and get this overdue Farm Bill done. It has not been since 2018 that a Farm Bill has actually been passed. We've just been 1 year reauthorizing that 2018 legislation since then. So it's time to get a new Farm Bill to reflect current market and economic conditions for agriculture, and we're hoping that this Congress will do so before the end of the year.
It is summer, and the Senate is set to break from July 1st through the 12th, and Texas Farm Bureau is urging quick action. You mentioned hoping that they can get around to taking action in August. How quickly could ranchers and farmers expect to see really the finalization of this 2026 Agriculture Act?
It's a good question, and there's a lot of factors that play into the timeline. You are in an election season in which there is a lengthy August recess, and then when members of Congress return after that August recess, they begin to quickly have a very finite number of days to consider legislation before they break for election purposes. So the timeline's tight. The chairman of the Senate committee has indicated he wants to begin markup and consideration of this bill in committee in August, and then after the break, hopefully take action and try to get that through. It is possible that the Congress that's called a lame duck Congress, which is the Congress that returns to Washington, D.C. after the November election, could perhaps consider the legislation in the Senate and consider if it were to pass, then go to conference committee in the House in a lame duck session. Don't know if that's probable, but it is a possibility based on the limited number of days that Congress has scheduled to consider legislation of this type.
Well, Gary Joyner, thank you so much. I know you're taking time out from the summer conference, and we appreciate your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you for your interest.
KACU's Heather Claiborne spoke with the Texas Farm Bureau about the farm bill awaiting the Senate's action.
In 2019, a student at McMurry University brought to light the lynching of Grover C. Everett in 1922. No one was ever convicted of that crime, but as KACU's Caleb Leger reports, injustice does not have the last word in this story.
Grover C. Everett was a black man staying in a black-only hotel in Abilene while working in town on a contract job. On the night of September 9, 1922, masked men entered the hotel, tracked down Everett, and shot him. Nearly 100 years after Everett was murdered, students and community leaders began working to commemorate Everett and establish a memorial. The community gathered on the Saturday morning of June 20th, 2026, on Ash Street, at the former site of the Joe Davis Hotel, for the unveiling of the plaque. Amy Boone, a key member of the research done on Everett and getting the plaque put up, opened the ceremony.
At the beginning of 2025, I became increasingly concerned about the widespread erasure of history happening across the country.
Grover C. Everett is part of a list of more than 700 documented lynchings in Texas. Not all the victims are commemorated by plaques, but the community worked with the Equal Justice Initiative to establish a memorial for Everett on the site of his murder. Artists Johnny Woodfolk and Susan Petty performed, and Malcolm Scott and Jane Ann Carroll read the inscriptions on the marker.
Lynching in America. Between 1865 and 1950, 6,500 black women, men, and children were victims of racial terror lynchings across the United States. Groups such as the Ku Klux Klan regularly sought to silence and intimidate black people through acts of terror that were meant to uphold white control.
Mr. Everett, who was around 36 years old, was the husband of Beulah Clay and had two sons, Willie Bill James and Lawrence.
Amy Boone invited those gathered to join in a responsive reading in remembrance of Grover Everett before Pastor Andrew Penns closed the ceremony with a prayer.
Let those who come after find him here.
And know that we refuse to forget.
Say his name.
Grover Everett.
So today we're going to pray and we want to remember and reflect and always have Grover C. Everett's name on our heart. Let us bow. Our most gracious and eternal Father.
Afterwards, Terrence Penn invited all to come to the follow-up reception at the Curtis House. Terrence is the curator of the Curtis House Cultural Center, who connected with Amy Boone while leading the Black History Tour Bus last year. This meeting reignited the fire that had been lit in 2019 to commemorate Everett with a historical plaque, but had been halted due to complications related to the COVID-19 pandemic.
I did learn about it when they first started the initiative back in 2019, when they started putting things together. And I think that was the first time anybody had ever found out about Grover C. Everett and the Klan activity here in Abilene. Obviously, people knew about the Klan activity in Abilene, just that particular moment didn't really stick out as much. But once they kind of did some digging and found everything out, like you said, then it came to light.
Pastor Andrew L. Penns, a docent and researcher at the Curtis House Cultural Center, worked with the committee from ACU and McMurry to research Everett's history and the story of his lynching.
We began to do some research, had to do some studies from the newspapers, speaking with various, some of the elderly that I knew. They knew of the hotel but didn't know much about the killing that had taken place. That's how we started getting to get familiar with Grover C. Everett.
Although the historical marker is now in place, Pastor Penn's research on Everett and his family is still continuing.
I definitely will be researching and trying to find some of his family members and see if we can get them to come to Abilene. And we can do a little bit, another celebration and let them know that the mark is there. I believe putting it out on social media, speaking about his life and what happened here in Abilene, Texas, will probably spark an interest, and family members will pick it up and say, that was my granddad or my father or whatever. Maybe we can go from there.
The possibility of understanding the whole story behind Grover C. Everett's lynching is unlikely, and the historical marker may receive backlash as others have before. Reiterating his prayer at the ceremony, Pastor Penns describes the effect he hopes the plaque will have on the community.
I'm hoping and praying for a more positive response. There will be some negative. We just have to be prepared for it. That's where we live in. But I'm praying that the positive will outweigh the negative, and that the mark itself would not be a symbol of racial hatred. I'm praying that it'll be something that would be a part of history.
Pastor Penns acknowledges that Abilene's checkered past is rough, but no matter how difficult history is, it needs to be, it must be shared and presented in the way that it happened. And for Abilene, this plaque, remembering Grover C. Everett, won't change the past, but it is a step forward in creating a better future.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm Braid Blanks. Next week marks the one-year anniversary of the historic and deadly flooding that tore through the Texas Hill Country on July 4th, killing more than 130 people. Since then, public radio stations across Texas have been following survivors and trying to answer questions about how this happened and if it could happen again. Houston Public Media's Dominique Anthony Walsh hosts After the Flood, a new five-part podcast from the Texas Newsroom and PBS's Frontline. Episode 1 is out now. Here's a preview.
On the morning of July 4th, 2025, an emergency dispatcher in the Texas Hill Country got a call.
Kerr County 911, what's the location of your emergency?
Here at Camp Mystic in Hunt, Texas. We need search and rescue.
Okay, what's going on?
We're missing as many as 20 to 40 people.
Hundreds of miles away in Houston, Matthew Childress was getting his day started.
Was ready for a non-work lazy Friday and was coming down and starting to check emails, have coffee, etc.
Matthew's 18-year-old daughter, Chloe, had left home to be a counselor that summer at Camp Mystic. The all-girls camp is one of over a dozen popular summer camps in Kerr County.
And probably about 30 minutes later, my wife came down and said that she was fielding texts from friends and family about flooding that was happening in the whole country and that we should be concerned.
Camp Mystic is right on the banks of the Guadalupe River, and on July 4th, 2025, hundreds of campers were on site. There had been a flash flood overnight, which isn't unusual in central Texas, but alarming images of the river surging over its banks started circulating around social media and the news. At home in Houston, Matthew's wife, Wendy, kept trying to text and call Chloe, but she didn't answer her phone. That wasn't necessarily cause for alarm. Camp Mystic did not allow campers or counselors to have phones. But Matthew and Wendy thought about just getting in their car and driving to Chloe.
So initially I was skeptical, thinking that, yes, it may have flooded, but I'm sure everything is okay. And do we need to get in the car and actually drive for 5 hours? Just my fear was is what we would drive there and then we'd be driving back.
But the concerned text messages from friends and family members kept coming. And to Matthew, the urgency of the situation became clear.
So we quickly grabbed bags, threw basically overnight clothes, and also packed a small bag for my daughter just in case she might need to come home with us. Threw it all in the car, and shortly thereafter, we were on the road.
Matthew aimed the car west on I-10. Along the way, Wendy tried reaching Chloe again. Still, nothing. Then, after an hour on the road, the phone rang. On the line was a representative from Camp Mystic.
She called to let us know that she was calling all families that had children that were unaccounted for. And she let us know that she had just called all the campers' parents and that we were the final people to be called because we were the counselors' parents to let us know that Chloe was unaccounted for. clearly our anxiety went through the roof. I was definitely driving faster than I probably should have been driving on the freeway, and I believe it was raining off and on. My sweet wife was telling me to slow down and be careful along the way, but all I could do was get there as quickly as I could to try to contribute something to help and find the girls.
You just heard some of After the Flood, a new podcast from the Texas Newsroom and Frontline covering last year's deadly floods in the Texas Hill Country. Also in the first episode, you will meet Houstonian Matthew Childress, whose daughter, Chloe, was an 18-year-old counselor at Camp Mystic who died in the flood. You'll also hear from residents who narrowly survived. Find After the Flood wherever you get your podcasts. There's just a little time left to share your favorite pieces of Texas music history for the Texas 250 Project. Here's the latest segment our friends at the Texas Standard have put together exploring key contributions Texas has made to the nation's music scene.
I'm Matt Riley from KUTX, and as we look towards the 250th birthday of the United States, we're celebrating with the Texas 250, the Lone Star State's contribution to American music. Here's a moment when Texas music had the world's attention. May 4th, 1965. Just a month earlier, on April 2nd, the Sir Douglas Quintet's single, She's About a Mover, entered the Billboard charts. Doug Somm led the quintet, joined by Augie Myers on Vox Organ, Jack Barber, Frank Marin, and Johnny Perez. Their sound was a mix of San Antonio's Chicano soul and Tejano music, along with rhythm and blues. Since it was the height of Beatlemania, their producer Huey Moe decided to lean in to that new sound. Moe's record business had taken a hit with the arrival of the British invasion, and he immersed himself in Beatles records over a two-day span, giving him a new direction to take the Sir Douglas Quintet. He then called up Doug Somm, told him to start growing his hair in a Beatle bob, and write a song that sounded like it came from across the pond. They even dressed the part in mod suits and Chelsea boots and didn't talk between songs so the audience wouldn't hear their Texas drawls. The Sir Douglas Quintet would come off as British lads.
The Sir Douglas Quintet!
The ruse didn't last long, though. The quintet appeared on the NBC TV program Hullabaloo, hosted by fellow Texan Trini Lopez, on a stage that continued the faux British theme with a fabricated castle, models in knight's armor, and Somm and the boys in full Mersey beat mode. Lopez came on after the song and told the audience, "But I have a surprise for you," before unmasking the Sir Douglas Quintet as Texans. "I bet we even fooled Lyndon," Lopez quipped.
Well, she was walking down the street, looking by.
You can see more about this moment at texasstandard.org/Texas250. And we want to hear from you. We're counting down the 250 essential Texas songs July 3rd and 4th on KUTX, and you can cast your vote for your favorite Texas song at texasstandard.org/Texas250.
It's time now for West Texas Roots. Most woodworkers only use scrap wood for testing out tools or lighting the fire pit. But for more than 20 years, Ron Harden uses only scrap wood to create his many pieces of work. From small crosses that fit in your pocket to larger projects that take over a year to piece together. And one of Ron's favorites is the piece depicting a First Baptist church that ended up on the wall of a Church of Christ church.
I do them all by hand with a scroll saw. I have several different types of saws that I use. And I tell people, I said, you got to remember, each one is handled and there is a prayer. It may be a blanket prayer over all these crosses for whoever gets them. I have 50 different designs and I give them, this is all I've already given one away this morning, because here's the testimony. You take this and don't worship the wood. You worship what it stands for, Jesus. And I say, just remember this. None of these are made out of wood that's been bought. This is all scrap woods. Everything I've got, scraps. I pick them up, I pick up pallets. People bring me dead trees. I live in the country. Bring me dead trees and things like that. And I make these things. Okay, if God will let me take scraps and make something that people kind of like, what will he do if you give him the scraps of your life? See what I'm saying? That's my testimony to these things. I've been doing this for about 20 years, and it has become something that is just, I'm obsessed that I have to tell that whenever I bring these out. And, you know, I can't carry all of these things around with me, and I don't push it on anybody. But if the door opens, I'm going to walk in because I believe in it so much. We decided to go to Fredericksburg, where I have a cousin that's a doctor, a lady doctor down there. And I didn't know that her mother was going to be there. Her mother's more my age. But as luck would have it, I'm not going to say that, as God would have it, we went down to see Patsy and Nancy. And I had my scrapbook. Patsy was going through them. She said, Ron, would you make me one of these? Pointing to the manger scene. I said, sure, be glad to, and didn't think any more about it. Well, we got in the car to come home, and we started to leave, and Jewel Marie says, you noticed Nancy giving her mother a pill, and I hadn't noticed that, but I didn't say anything about it. She has pancreatic cancer, stage 4. She asked me to make that manger. I gotta make it. So, as soon as we got home, I hit the shop, and I'd build a certain section of it. I'd take a picture of it. I'd send it, picture, to Nancy, and she'd show it to her mother. Did them all that way, every section, and I finally got it done. And the way I have it built is it'll all fit, all of those bases come off, and it all fits right down inside that barn. And so I put it in a box, and I mailed it to her. She sent me a note. She says, we got the manger and I've got it set up. 2 days after that, she sent me a note. She says, Mama died. I'm sitting with my mouth open because my hair on the back of my neck is raising up, and it does every time I tell that story, because that had to be God-led for me to get home and get busy, because it took a week. It took me a week to make it. And I didn't work on anything but that. When I worked with the funeral home, we did a funeral at a Church of Christ. And in the bathroom, you know, the molding up on the top up here was this church. And I thought, oh, sure, neat. I'm gonna make one of those. I took a picture of it, sketched it all out and put it all together. And I thought, you know, that needs a sign. I knew the preacher of the church, Church of Christ, okay? And I'm not making fun of anybody because he was a close friend. I taught school with him, Mike Hardaway. I took that with me. Next time I saw him, I said, I made this from that thing you had in the bathroom back there. And he looked and said, oh, that is so nice. I says, yeah. I says, bring it up and look at that sign. What does it say? First Baptist Church. Oh, mercy. That was one of the funny stories that I've had in life.
We recorded Ron Hardin's story of woodworking at the Taylor County Expo Center. This is the West Texas Dispatch. As families spread out, it is harder to preserve family history than it once was. Passing along basic details like your grandma's favorite song or a recipe handed down through generations happens less and less when families spend less time together.
In fact, in the span of just three generations, these stories and memories are usually lost if they go undocumented. Robert Cruitt, the vice president of the West Texas Genealogical Society, spoke with KACU's Caleb Leger about how and why documenting and researching family history and genealogy is so important.
What got you interested in being a part of the society?
Well, it all began when I was about 17 years old, and I had just finished a church directory that my family and I had been a part of for many years in East Texas, and I felt like I needed another project. I was in my senior year of high school, and I was living with my grandparents at the time, and my grandmother and I sat down, and we began to talk about her family, and I was like, so do we have a family history recorded about it? You know, who were your aunts and uncles and cousins and so on? And so she was very excited. She said, well, I don't know very much, but it was funny whenever you say that, if you sit down, that information just kind of flows out.
Okay. So that was part of my next question was, like, you were at the society after it was founded, or is that
correct?
Right?
Okay. The West Texas Genealogical Society was actually formed on October 27th, 1958, and it was founded by Mrs. Dallas Scarborough at the Fair Park Recreation Building in Abilene, and they held their first genealogical society meeting in November, and then in January 1959, they elected officers. And so that's when the actual society began in Abilene.
All right, so how have the society's goals changed over the years? And if so, what ways have they changed?
Well, in the beginning, they wanted to begin preserving as much history of Taylor County and surrounding counties. It actually encompasses about 13 counties when they began. They began to do their best to transcribe tombstones and cemeteries. They wrote some books. And over the years, they continue to do so, but not so much recently. We are in hopes, though, to actually begin doing more digitization of records that could be at different archives that have not been, libraries, our own family histories, etc.
So to kind of tie into what you said about its importance, why or could you tell us why you believe that it's important to record your family's history?
Sure. So it's not just for publication or anything. I feel like it's a more intimate type thing. As I said, when I was about 17, when I began, I would sit down with my grandparents and I would hear their stories. And I've got several of them written down and I treasure them every day. And I don't just keep them to myself. I've shared them with family and friends. I just feel like for someone in the family that might come along either years later or currently in the family that might get the genealogy bug, if you want to call it that, to be able to learn about them. I mean, there's so much more about a person than what you can just read on a piece of paper, like what their where they lived, what their physical traits were. But not just that, but what kind of foods did grandma love to make? You know, what recipes was she handed down, you know? And, you know, same with grandpa or someone, you know, in the family or uncles. What traits were they taught? My grandfather was a jack of all trades. Unfortunately, I am not. But that was a generation that just took on all the training. They didn't really rely on other people. They just learned it. And they were very intelligent to do so. But preserving stories are just very meaningful and important to do. So that's why.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. My grandma started recording our family's history, and it's incredible, like, the stuff that she has done. And so I still believe that it's very important to record some of that stuff. So now, how does the society affect and shape the community?
We're kind of starting back, getting out into the community again. Unfortunately, I feel like so many people in the community and the surrounding areas have no knowledge of our society. With the encouragement from others that it can help them to want to look into their roots, because it is so important, and preserve their stories, both either on a digital format or on a physical, whatever they're most comfortable with.
And so what is the difference between ancestry and genealogy?
Well, ancestry, you would be focusing more, I believe, on the direct line in your family, as well as I call it the sidelines, the aunts, the uncles, cousins, and doing descendancy research. And genealogy, I would feel, is more like gathering those stories, gathering maybe the evidence to create your stories, making an impact on your community to help others. And I enjoy doing it. As I said, being raised by my grandparents and all, I grew up with that generation of senior citizens. And so I felt more comfortable. I could relate more with that generation than my own and all. So anyway, that's part of my oddity, but that's okay.
So how can people be more involved within the society?
Sure. They can contact us on Facebook or on Instagram. We currently meet every second Tuesday of the month, except for the months of November and December. July and August meetings will be held at the main branch of the Abilene Public Library, and then September and October are to be determined. If you are interested in learning more about your family history, please reach out to us. We would be willing to help you do some research. We're on Facebook, and we also are on Instagram.
That's really incredible to hear that there's still people who care about their family's history. My name is Caleb Leger, and thank you for coming in, Robert.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Again, that's Robert Cruitt, the Vice President of the West Texas Genealogical Society, speaking with KACU's Caleb Leger. You can find the group on Facebook by searching the West Texas Genealogical Society, Abilene, Texas. They meet the second Tuesday of each month at the South Branch of the Abilene Public Library. Thanks for tuning in to the West Texas Dispatch today. We are here every Wednesday at noon. We hope you'll come back next week. And never miss an episode when you subscribe to the West Texas Dispatch podcast, which is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also find it on the KACU mobile app. Our executive producer is Heather Claiborne, and we had help from producers Shayla Conley and Caleb Leger. Calvin Claiborne is our digital editor. And a special thanks to J.C. Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm Braid Blanks.